Hello, and welcome to Afternoonified,
the podcast that you have to forward to at least five people or a demon baby will show up in your closet. I'm Emily.
I'm Sarah. This is not the new marketing plan we discussed.
It makes it sound like we discuss marketing plans.
It's called the Instagram.
We just kind of put it out and hope people find us. And it's
sometimes
worked.
Sometimes we add some tags and it's worked at least once.
At least one person listens to this.
I can think of at least one person who has found us through a hashtag. So,
oh, hi, person who found us through a hashtag. What's that like? I'm being an asshole. I do appreciate every single person that listens to this podcast.
I also appreciate every single person who interacts with our Instagram.
Oh, yeah. Also, shout out to, who is it? Which friend of yours had the nice deets on Caesar?
Liesl.
Liesl, yes. Thank you. I very clearly just like half memorized a fact that I skimmed when I was doing other research.
Are you going to share with the audience what the deets about Caesar were?
Well, let me just scroll past like a week's worth of our text messages.
Between ourselves.
I mean, she knows what I'm talking about. yep. Okay. Here we go. I'm just going to read her text to you that you screenshotted and sent to me. It's like listener email, except, you know, 3 degrees of separation. And then we'll have Kevin Bacon on the podcast to, anyway. All right. So I just listened to the Cleopatra episode of your podcast, and Emily made an offhanded comment that it bothers her that October isn't the 8th month of the year. I just have to chime in and let you guys know that it used to be the 8th month of the year. The year used to have 10 months, and September 7, October 8th, November 9th, and December 10th were the last four. If you were wondering which two were added, it's January and February.
Oh.
And then there was an article that you screenshotted the link to, so I actually didn't read it, but...
No, I sent you the screenshot, and then I also sent you the link.
Did you?
Yes.
I'm doing great.
I didn't read the link, though, so I'm not going to hold it against you if you didn't.
Julius Caesar added them, and yeah. Anyway, we shouldn't have let them be in charge of the months.
Yeah.
Anyway,
we shouldn't let men be in charge of anything, but here we are.
As we've established from the previous episode. Oh my god, happy Ides of March, Sarah!
Oh god. Well, it is appropriate that we are this evening
back
dunking
here
on Caesar.
Much like Brutus. All right. Well, we're not talking about Romans. Well, that's not 100% true. I really just stepped in it with that one. Today, as you've probably gathered, we are going to talk about cursed objects. I have selected four. Used to be six, and then I got carried away, so it's four.
I bet it's the four most interesting ones, though.
No, I actually picked the four worst ones, and then we'll get... No. I'll do a part two at some point. There's a lot of cursed objects. I actually purchased a book, which I had been meaning to buy anyways, but this was a good excuse. We're going to talk about four of them, which is not even close to a percentage of the number of cursed objects out there, but
I mean,
they were the ones that I liked.
Think of how much junk is in the world. I expect there's quite a few.
First, we'll talk about some semantics and explanations. Source-wise, I relied very heavily on the book I just mentioned called Cursed Objects by J.W. Auchincloss. It's a good book. It's not like super scholarly. It's more like kind of like a little Atlas Obscura kind of situation.
Okay. A little Reader's Digest sort of compendium.
Yeah. It's a listicle, but it's a book.
I love those kind of books.
He wrote it really well. It's easy read. As we're all well aware, these kind of stories don't have like the Smithsonian as a source.
No, because I assume curses aren't real.
Well, back before I took it off, there was an object that was literally in the Smithsonian, and I couldn't find good curse-related articles. So there you go. So my sources are, God, it's the book, The Cursed Objects by J.W. Auchincloss. Medium, Thought Co., a website called theghostdoctor.com. Wikipedia, drdavidclark.co.uk. Like I said,
we're not, sometimes it's not looking for scholarly history. It's looking for stories, and stories can be told by anybody.
That's the beauty of a story. I'm not claiming any of this is factually accurate at all. That's what I liked when I did Boo-ha-ha, is that I didn't have to prove shit. I could find one source in a tiny corner of the internet and be like, yes, this is the story I shall do.
Yes.
All right. So first up, sorry, Webster's Dictionary defines, no, we're not, we are going to do the definition of what a cursed object is. I don't think there actually is a formal definition. So for guidance on what constitutes as cursed, we're going to go with this quote from the book Cursed Objects. Cursed is often used synonymously with haunted and possessed, but these three qualities are distinct. For our purposes, the difference is one of intelligence. Cursed items have none. They're objects that have become bad luck via someone who has purposefully cursed them or by happenstance. By contrast, a haunted object has a spirit intelligence attached directly to it, and a possessed item is similarly inhabited, in this case, by a demonic entity. Although some say that an object cannot technically be possessed, only humans can.
Just talking about how none of these sources are scholarly, but this is a very scholarly breakdown of like cursed versus haunted objects, and I enjoy it a lot.
Both haunted and possessed objects can function practically as cursed objects if they bring misfortune to enough people, but if they merely act spooky, they're not cursed. So, Robert the Doll, cursed.
Yes.
But also haunted? No, he's haunted and cursed. He's a double threat. Or triple threat. He might also be possessed. I don't know. Well, we talked about Robert the Doll like a long time ago, but he may merit his own episode.
Yeah, probably. Scraped together enough about Robert for an episode.
Well, and I would say that like Robert haunted and cursed because he has brought bad luck upon people who have spoken ill of him at his museum, whereas Annabelle just haunted. You couldn't Sounds see funny. The massive air quotes around that, but all right, so that covers kind of what we're dealing with. And now for the other introductory bit. I know a lot of you, Sarah included, are not going to believe me when I say this, but there is some scientific evidence that cursed objects are kind of real.
I'm actually very interested to hear this.
Cool.
Because I'm like, so, certainly there's an angle here.
Well, so you might be familiar with the placebo effect, where patients feel better when they've been told that they've been given a treatment that they haven't been given. There's also the nocebo effect. I'm serious.
Who named who was in charge of naming this?
Probably we'll get to it. Yep. coined as the nocebo reaction by Walter Kennedy in a scientific paper written in 1961, the nocebo effect is when a patient experiences negative side effects because they believe that they've been given a treatment with negative side effects, even when they haven't. For example, if a patient is told that a medication could cause you to hallucinate music, they might experience musical hallucinations, regardless of whether that's an actual side effect or not.
Interesting.
The nocebo effect has similarities with the idea of something called voodoo death, a term created by a doctor named Walter Cannon in 1942. Voodoo death is when someone is scared to death after believing that they've been cursed. The death is psychosomatic, as is the nocebo effect, meaning there's nothing actually happening except in your brain, which means that something is happening because your brain, mm-hmm. there's chemical reactions and stuff, like something is actually happening to you. So basically, if you think harm will come to you because of a cursed object, you and or your body will sometimes create that outcome. Make sense?
Yeah. And like, see, I totally buy this because I really do think like the brain is capable of some pretty crazy shit and you can literally think your way into being cursed.
Like, that well, makes it's sense kind of like if you're like anxious about having stomach cancer and your anxiety gives you a stomach ache and then you're like, mm-hmm. oh, shit. So
I knew it.
We create our own reality and all of that.
Yeah.
Confirmation bias. Like,
yeah.
If you pick up a what's
and then you're also more likely, to like ascribe anything bad that happens mm-hmm. to you. You're like on the lookout. You're paying attention to all the bad things that are happening to you.
Yeah. You become hyper aware of anything bad.
Mm-hmm. And more dismissive of anything good.
Our first haunted object is one of my favorites because it's a classic, like the Coca-Cola classic of cursed objects. I am, of course, talking about the crying boy painting.
I hate this thing. Yes.
So you've seen him.
Yes, I am aware. It is a creepy-ass painting.
I love haunted paintings. It's one of my favorite episodes of Supernatural is the painting with the little girl with the razor blade. Love
it. That was one of the first things I thought of was specifically that episode. That's a good. The first season of Supernatural was just like really good, like just like basic so horror shit.
Solid. Yeah, I really love Monster of the Week stuff like that. Obviously, yeah. I love Monster of the Week.
Yeah, it's when they like start, and not just Supernatural, but like any shows, when they start getting up their own ass with the lore is when it like.
That's my least favorite part of X-Files is when they do like the government conspiracy stuff, which is the heart of the show. Like, I'm not going to hold that against them. It's just I prefer it when like Mulder gets an alien cold and like Scully has to find him Robitussin.
Yeah.
All right. So on September 5th, 1985, Bastion of Honest British Journalism, The Sun, premiered an article titled, quote, Blazing Curse of the Crying Boy, which definitely sounds like a postmodern album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like maybe the Talking Heads. The story alleged that a couple named Ron and Mary Hall lost their home to a fire when a frying pan burst into flames. Although the whole house was destroyed, one item remained, a print of a painting of a crying boy. And I would describe the painting, but it's a painting, probably originally oil, of a little boy crying. Like it's from the chest up.
It'll also be on our Instagram.
Oh, yeah. It like you're kind of looking down at this boy. It's from the chest up. He's wearing a white shirt. It's incredibly generic, which will be a plot point in the story later. The response to the article was overwhelming. Within a day, hundreds of readers had reached out to the newspaper claiming to be jinxed by the painting, a minor hysteria that was only fueled by Ron Hall's brother, a fireman, claiming that one of his associate firemen had told him. So Ron heard from his brother, who heard from his coworker, about numerous other cases where prints of the crying boy had turned up undamaged in the ruins of homes destroyed by fires.
Oh, there's like a whole genre of crying boy paintings I'm seeing.
Just wait. It'll come up.
Love it.
I also ate a 5-milligram edible right before we started, so enjoy. So the legend grew bigger as imaginations ran wild, and some people claimed that the painting had caused the death of family members. Others reported that they had tried to burn the prints, and they would not catch fire. Even restaurants with crying boy prints were burned to the ground. Eventually, well. Eventually enough was enough, and with people desperate to get rid of their copies of the painting, Kelvin McKenzie, editor of The Sun, came up with a solution. He told readers to send in their paintings and that The Sun would destroy them once and for all. On Halloween, the newspaper staff burned more than 2,500 copies of the painting.
Holy shit.
I know. It almost seems like not good, but also it's just like a painting.
I mean, they clearly didn't have any issue getting rid of them. Unless we're about to hear that, like, they set fire to all the paintings, but, like, there was one left or something.
No, they all burned. Like, there was no follow-up on that. Maybe they had, like, a priest come and bless it. I don't know. It was, like, the middle of the Satanic Panic, which apparently was also happening in the UK.
Oh, yeah.
So why this painting? Why a curse? What the fuck is happening? Well, interest eventually died down after the burning, but it was revived in the 2000s in a book of ghost stories called Haunted Liverpool, where an origin story was given, though I cannot confirm that this book was researched at all.
I mean, I would not expect a book called Haunted Liverpool to have much in the way of actual research.
No. The backstory was, I'm going to use the word allegedly in this episode a lot. The backstory was allegedly uncovered by, quote, a well-respected researcher into the occult matters, a retired schoolmaster from Devon named George Mallory, in 1995. Mallory traced the artist who had painted the original, an old Spanish portrait artist named Francho Seville, who lives in Madrid.
Oh.
Eh. Seville told Mallory the subject of the painting was a little street urchin he had found wandering around Madrid in 1969. He never spoke and had a very sorrowful look in his eyes. And this guy was like, I must paint this sadness.
I must paint this sad boy.
Paint me like one of your Spanish street urchins.
A plus joke.
I don't know. After the painting was complete, a Catholic priest identified the child as Don Bonillo, a child who had run away after seeing his parents die in a fire. The priest, I don't know why the priest didn't help, whatever. The priest warned Seville to leave the child alone because wherever he settled, fires of unknown origin would mysteriously break out. The villagers had named him Diablo because of this. It's like Firestarter. This poor kid. Seville ignored, I think it's pronounced Seville. That's how you pronounce the town, right?
I think it's technically pronounced like Sevilla, but like I think Seville is a appropriate or not an appropriate, just like accepted.
Close enough. So he ignored the priest's advice and adopted the boy. His portraits sold well, but one day his studio was destroyed in a fire and the artist was ruined. He accused the little boy of arson and Bonillo ran off in tears and was never seen again. As the story goes, from across Europe came reports of the unlucky crying boy paintings causing fires. Seville was also regarded as a jinx and no one commissioned him to paint or would even look at his paintings. In 1976, a car exploded into a fireball on the outskirts of Barcelona after crashing into a wall. The victim was charred beyond recognition, but part of the victim's driver's license in the glove compartment was only partly burned. The name on the license was 19-year-old Don Bonillo. All right, back to the real world. Eventually, it emerged that the cursed prints were not all copies of the same painting, nor were they all prints by the same artist.
Interesting. Interesting wrinkle.
The picture that survived the fire in Rotherham? Whatever. The first one that we talked about in 1985 that the Sun reported on. Anyway, it was signed by artist G. Bragolin. Bragolin? Anyway, the Sun claimed that the original was by an Italian artist. Giovanni Bragolin was actually a pseudonym adopted by a Spanish painter, Bruno Amadio, who is also known as Francho Seville. In the 1950s, Amadio made a series of paintings that depicted a young child crying. He sold those paintings to tourists as a reminder of the orphans of World War II. And oddly enough, people in England, especially young couples, seemed to really like the paintings, and mass prints were sold in department stores across the country.
What psychological damage? I mean, I guess the answer is probably also World War II.
World War II. To make matters more confusing, other crying boy paintings featured in the fires were part of a series of paintings called Childhood by Scottish artist Anna Zinkensen, who died in 1976. The only common denominator with the paintings is that they were all examples of cheap, mass-produced prints sold in large numbers by English department stores during the 60s and 70s.
So, like, just, like, a really weird, not a micro-trend even, because it lasted so long, but just, like...
It's just death by kitsch.
Everyone in England just wanted these crazy crying kid pictures.
Well, maybe it was kind of like in the 90s when everyone had, like, a dolphin-themed bathroom and, like, a grape-themed kitchen.
Yes. Yeah. Your kitchen could either be vineyard or roosters. It's the only
vineyard
choices.
Roosters or that fat little Italian chef.
Yes.
Oh, that one was my favorite. I think my mom had more of like a vintage Coca-Cola kitchen.
Oh yeah,
but we see that. We also had a room that was like Route 66 themed, where she kept all of her like vintage Barbie, Elvis, and Beatles memorabilia.
Your mom was just the queen of kitsch. I love it.
Yeah, I make a lot of sense now that I look back on this.
Yeah, it's like I'm seeing some through lines, but I wasn't gonna.
Yep.
I wasn't gonna say anything because I didn't want you to get defensive about it.
No, it's fine. It's kind of like when I read that like autism and ADHD can be hereditary. I'm like, that's weird. And I'm like, my dad makes miniature cars as a hobby and has for the last like 40 years.
Explains a lot.
Yeah. All right. So. Maybe it's just paintings of crying children that are cursed, and maybe you don't have them in your home. But as a warning, here's a list of incidents associated with crying boy paintings across England. And if I pronounce any of these British towns wrong, I'm sorry. Y'all need to learn how to spell it like you say it. Dora Brand of Mitcham, Surrey, had her house reduced to rubble 6 weeks after she bought a crying child painting, although it was among many others she owned. It was the only one that survived the fire.
Interesting.
On October 21st, 1985, the Perio Pizza Palace in Great Yarmouth, Norfolk, was gutted by a fire, although its prominently displayed crying boy picture remained in pristine condition. The Perio Pizza Palace in Norfolk.
No notes.
On October 24th, 1985, the Godper family of Herringthorpe, South Yorkshire, lost their home in an unexplained fire. crying boy picture on their living room mantle stayed unmarked while everything else had been consumed by fire. On October 25th, 1985, in Heswell, Merseyside, you people and your fucking Lord of the Rings names, a pair of paintings hanging in the living and dining room of the house belonging to the Amos family were found intact after a gas explosion destroyed the building. They had two crying child pictures.
That's too many. You don't... I would argue you don't need any, but you own at most one.
In November 1985, one woman from Leeds who destroyed her picture of the crying boy seems certain that its destruction was to blame for the deaths in a fire of her husband and three sons.
Oh, there's a twist in that one.
Yeah, this is after the big burning. The next two are also after the big burning. On November 12, 1985, Malcolm Vaughan of Churchdown, Gloucestershire, helped destroy a neighbor's picture. He returned home to find his own living room ablaze for reasons which firemen were unable to explain. Why does a neighbor need help? on December, this, I'm going to say this one is my favorite, but I don't mean it like that. And you'll see why I don't mean it like that in a second. In December of 1985, 67-year-old William Armitage died in a mysterious fire that swept through his house in Weston-super-Mare, Avon. It's a place someone lives. Like, Weston-super-Mare is three words hyphenated.
Oh, yeah. Usually it's said to do, like, place names get repeated, so they have to, like, distinguish between, like, which one is on the river, which one is on the
this plane. One just has a really big horse, I guess.
Yes.
Anyway, it was discovered that a crying boy picture was found lying intact beside the pensioner's charred body. One of the firemen who dealt with the blaze was afterwards quoted as saying, quote, I've never believed in the jinx up until now, but when you actually come across a picture in a gutted room and it's literally the only thing that hasn't been touched, it's most odd.
Most odd. Yes.
I feel like we talked about this guy in our spontaneous human combustion episode, but
maybe.
All right. So that's the crying boy painting. Just don't have paintings of crying children in your house.
Yeah, easy.
Done.
I mean, I know what I'm getting you for Christmas now, but...
I want it to be the crying boy painting from Coraline, though, where it's like a little boy in like short pants with an ice cream cone crying.
Oh, yes.
I don't want this creepy ass, like, chest up street urchin. I want a fancy sad boy. All right. So for this next one, I'm about to say a series of words that's going to sound like I just made it up, but I need you to bear with me. Our next object is Busby's stoop chair. And we're going to start with a little story from the late 17th century in a town called Kirby Whisk in North Yorkshire, England.
England's just jammed with haunted or cursed objects, huh?
I think
it's got thousands and thousands of these cursed boy paintings.
Actually, yeah, three chair. Of four stories are in England. I didn't do it on purpose. They just have better cursed shit, I guess.
Yeah, that seems fair.
So in the 17th century, a guy named Daniel Oddy was a fairly successful counterfeiter. Of course, it was the 17th century and currency was like gold coins and shit. So it wasn't hard to counterfeit.
Yeah, there wasn't like security.
Security ribbons. They didn't have like a pen that you could mark the coin with. So also in tow. Was his daughter Elizabeth. He purchased an old farm and built himself a large, hidden, secure underground room in which to commit his crimes and renamed the farm Danity Hall. He also picked up an apprentice, a local man with a reputation for being a drunk, named, wow, I just didn't put his name in. Hold, please. Thomas Busby. So dude name.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So he picked up an apprentice, a local man with a reputation for being a drunk named Thomas Busby. So Elizabeth apparently saw something in this man. I don't know what. And they decided to get married. Which.
Why not?
Oddy didn't love this.
Yeah.
I can't have my daughter marrying a criminal who works for me. So Busby and Elizabeth took up residence at a local inn a little ways down the road from Danity Hall. It's just a great place for a drunk to live. Inn and tavern.
Mm-hmm.
Inn is kind of synonymous with bar or pub, you know? It's like all hotels have a hotel bar. Well, most hotels have a hotel bar. Is that a U.S. thing?
No, not necessarily.
Because I always assumed in England, like, you could get a drink at an inn that you were staying at.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter. You just know that you can drink at this inn.
It'd be disappointing if you couldn't.
Yeah. I mean, it was the 17th century. There was nothing else to do. Eventually, Adi couldn't take it anymore and headed to the inn to collect his daughter instead of just letting her make her own decisions. But she refused to leave until Busby got home from wherever he happened to be at the time. So they sat and waited until a very drunk Busby arrived, and then a fight began. Adi was mad about the whole daughter thing, and Busby was mad because Adi was sitting in his favorite chair.
Both equally stupid, honestly.
The whole story hinges on the fact that Busby had a favorite chair. Adi eventually went home, but Busby wasn't finished with him. And sometime that night, Busby made the 3-mile walk to Danity Hall and beat his father-in-law to death with one of his counterfeiting hammers.
Yikes. That...
Yikes indeed.
It's a disproportionate response.
To sitting in his favorite chair? Yeah. I assume some words were exchanged during the argument that were not chair-related, but still...
I assume also just like, you know, the general buildup of animosity between these two men, but also get over yourself.
Just don't murder someone. It's very easy.
It's very easy.
So Adi's body was eventually found, and Busby was charged, trialed, and found guilty of murder in 1702. One variation of the story has Busby cursing the chair whilst on his way to his execution, whereas another says he was drunk in the chair when he was arrested and cursed it then. Either way, he cursed anyone who sat in the chair with death, which I guess you can just do.
I definitely do like the second version of that a little better because it just seems stretching disbelief
like they were,
a little bit that like he's getting hauled off to be executed and he's still thinking about his goddamn
chair. Don't sit my fucking chair! After laying down this curse, Busby was led to the gallows, hanged, dipped in pitch, and hung from a gibbet as sort of a cautionary tale to the villagers.
As you do.
Yep. After the execution, the inn was renamed the Busby Stoop Inn. It's not a good name.
No, I just love that, like, you know, you know what a good name for this
capitalize.
Let's name it after this murderer who was hanged and displayed.
The owner of the inn made sure to tell everyone who visited about the chair and its curse, and they even left it sitting in Busby's usual spot. And it proved to be quite an attraction. But why are we still talking about it now? If the legends are true, and for the purpose of this episode they are, the chair has claimed up to 63 lives over the centuries.
That's pretty impressive for a chair.
Right? I mean, I couldn't find 63 verified stories, but let's go with it. So yeah, the chair took the lives of up to 63 people who dared to sit in it. And I don't mean like they keeled over as soon as ass hit wood. Like
they sat in the chair and then some terrible happened. Befall them. Yeah.
Yes, they met untimely ends not long after the sitting. It wasn't like, oh, sitting, ugh, that'd be wild.
I imagine if that did start to happen and we had like documented proof of that, they'd be much more certain about the deadliness of this chair and it wouldn't be just like, you know, vague stories about a curse.
The thing with cursed objects, it's like, it always just seems kind of incidental.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's most curses.
Well, yes. So, for example, locals claim that during the Second World War, Canadian airmen from a nearby base at Skipton-on-Swale went to the pub, and those who sat in the chair never returned from bombing missions over in mainland Europe, which makes me feel like they played musical chairs, because were they just, like, switching chairs all night?
Yeah, that's...
After that, a young builder's apprentice died soon after having lunch at the inn. His workmates dared him to sit in the chair, which he did, and then later that day he fell through a roof.
Not great.
No. A delivery man sat in the chair while it was stored away in the cellar as the current landlord was getting sick of all of the deaths. He died in a car crash that evening when he lost control of his delivery truck.
Damn.
Then there was a chimney sweep who sat in the chair one evening while drinking at the inn. He left at some hour of the night and morning, but was found hanging from a gatepost next to the mock Busby gibbet located next to the inn.
That seems suspicious.
Doesn't it?
Sounds like an innkeeper wanting to make sure everybody knows about this cursed chair.
Even well into the 70s, the locals were fearful of the curse. Soon the inn would be free of the chair's terror, but it would take two more deaths. Two young airmen sat in the inn one night, daring each other to sit in the chair, as drunk young men do.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, one of them caved and sat for just a second. On their way back to the field, they both died in a car accident. I'm going to say it was because they were drinking and driving, but...
Yeah, I do love that, like, most of these stories hinge on, like, stupid men with dangerous jobs. Just, you know, maybe a factor. Just saying.
Well, that, That was apparently the last straw, and the pub owner took the chair over to the local museum. And to this day, the chair is mounted high up on the wall of the Thirsk Museum, and no one has been allowed to sit in it.
That's probably for the best.
Yeah, we're also going to ignore the bit where the chair was found to have been much newer than 300 years old.
I mean, I think that goes without saying.
Yeah. As a final note, Busby himself has been seen around the inn on occasion, taking the form of a dark shadow on the upper floor landings. And I say inn, but the building is apparently an Indian restaurant now.
I like that. That's a great ending.
Reverse colonization.
Yes.
Your historic inn is an Indian place now. Whatever about the chair. But small town England Indian food gives me pause.
I don't know. It depends on who is making it.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like small town America Chinese food. Well, West Coast small town Chinese food is usually some of the best like American Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would eat Chinese food in like a town of 2,000 people in like the Midwest.
I mean, I have. It's good. It's not authentic.
Well, no. England is supposed to have really good Indian food anyways, probably because they stole all of it. Whatever. Next story. We'll save that discussion for a different episode. All right. So this one actually takes place in the U.S. It's the only one that I picked that does. And it's another classic scenario. And it's maybe a little cliche, but I like it. So shut up.
Sometimes cliches are cliches for a reason.
Yeah. Also, a trigger warning for mentions of suicide. Because unlike Sarah, I warn you before I tell you something horrible.
I'm sorry. I forgot the article got that grab. Don't trigger warning for next week's mini. Don't listen
there
to it.
There you go. Our listenership just plummets. She said not to listen to it. It's cursed. Ooh, the next mini is cursed.
The next mini is in fact cursed. Yes.
That'll be the title. This mini is cursed. All right. But for right now, we're going to talk about the gravestone of Carl Pruitt.
That you're going to say the Carlsbad Caverns. It's like, damn.
No, my brain was telling me to say the Carlstone of Grave Pruitt.
Yes.
And it is located in Pulaski County, Kentucky. So Carl was a carpenter who, upon arriving home from a long day of carpentry, there we go. In order to like motivate myself to write my notes, because I like learning, it's just, as you well know, the writing, the script part.
Mm-hmm.
I will eat an edible and then kind of see how much I can get done before I can't. And I would say that this is about the point when I stop doing the notes for the day.
This is the can't, yeah.
From his long day of carpenting. In 1938. But when he arrived home, he made a nasty discovery. His wife was nowhere to be found when he entered the house. But after a little bit of searching, she was found in the bedroom with another guy. It was not Carl.
Poor Carl.
Yep.
Sorry,
yeah,
dude.
The man, you're not going to say that in a second. The man managed to escape through a window, but Mrs. Pruitt wasn't so lucky. Carl grabbed a chain, and no, I don't know why there was a chain in their bedroom, and he strangled his wife to death.
I've lost all sympathy for Carl.
Yep. Unable to handle what he had just done, Carl shot himself. But according to local folklore, this is not the end of Carl Pruitt's rage. He sounds, and it'll make more sense as I go on, he sounds like a 13 Ghosts character.
I mean, there's chains involved already, which is crazy.
Yeah. So because his wife's family was unable to forgive Carl, understandably, he was buried in a different cemetery in a different town.
Good.
After his burial, people noticed a circular discoloration on his tombstone. And over the next few weeks, a series of interlocking circles appeared on it, like a chain. Soon, another row of circles intersected the previous row, forming a cross. There was even talk about removing the mysterious tombstone, but they ultimately left it where it was. So while that's weird and creepy, it's not really a curse. But what happened a month after the chains stopped growing steered public opinion into potential curse territory. So several boys rode their bikes out to the cemetery to get a look at the haunted tombstone, which is a respectful activity for any young hoodlum. Fuck, I still do it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the boys, named James Collins, threw a rock at Pruitt's tombstone and chipped it. Eventually the boys got bored and started home, but James Collins would not make it out of the cemetery. On the way out, he lost control of his bike and hit a tree, which usually isn't a fatal accident when you're on a Huffy.
Yeah, damn.
When his friends checked to see if he was okay, they found that he was not. He was dead, but not from a head. His bike chain had somehow wrapped itself around his neck and strangled him. And please do not ask me how it's... I don't know how it's physically possible.
I mean, I assume it wasn't, and it's just a story. But, I mean...
Whatever. As if that wasn't weird... Well... As if that wasn't weird enough, the next day the damage to Pruitt's headstone was gone, and only the oddly shaped stain remained. Driven insane by her son's death, James Collins's mother made a visit to the cemetery a few weeks later, pickaxe in hand. She hacked away at the headstone in a grief-fueled rage, leaving it in pieces. After her little outing, she returned home to hang the laundry out to dry. You know when you have a mental breakdown, destroy a grave, and then go home and do the laundry?
As you do. Yeah.
As she was hanging sheets on the line to dry, a line that for some reason was actually a chain, I don't know, wrapped itself around her neck and strangled her.
That's terrible. This is starting in, I'm sorry if I'm foreshadowing.
It's we're heading into Goosebumps territory.
It is really starting to read like someone saw this discoloration on the grave and then re-engineered a story to explain it.
Oh, probably. When locals went to see the damage she had done to the tombstone, they found that it was once again intact, aside from the stain.
Interesting.
The story of the curse spread, and it wasn't long before someone else decided to test the spirit of Carl Pruitt. A farmer driving by the cemetery in a horse-drawn cart shot at the headstone with a gun.
This can't end well.
Well, no. His horse, startled by the gunshot, took off running, pitching the farmer forward over the front of the cart, where he died with the chain from the horse harness wrapped around his neck.
Of course, yes.
The tombstone was fine. So now, you'd think that people would stop fucking with the headstone or stay away from chains.
Yeah, maybe ban all chains in this town.
Well, it sounds like this town had a chain-based economy.
There was actually a chain factory in the town. So there's just so much going on that everything's made of chains because there's just so many chains around.
That's where Carl did his carpenting, the chain factory. Anyway, law enforcement got involved.
A good use of their time.
A pair of police officers went to investigate and, I guess, see what they could see. While they were there, one of the officers made fun of the headstone and Carl. And upon leaving the cemetery, they were chased by a ghost light, causing the offending officer to panic. He swerved between two posts and crashed. The officer in the passenger seat was thrown clear and survived, while the driver was found dead, strangled by a chain that connected the two posts.
Yeah, sounds about right.
All right. So now the body count stands at one police officer, one man in a cart, one mom, and a small boy. Yep. Well, probably a teenage boy. Carl would get one last kill in before the townspeople took action. A man, apparently frustrated by the story, or maybe some other stuff going on at home that he needed an outlet for, took a hammer and chisel to the headstone.
I mean, we've tried this before.
Well, no one really knows what happened, but he was found the next morning, strangled by the chain from the graveyard gate. The hammer and chisel were both there, but there were no marks on the grave.
This is the point where the story stops trying. It's just like... No one knows what happened. Like, I'm done coming up with Final Destination type deaths.
I need to watch Final Destination.
Have you never seen it?
No.
I think I've only seen, like, the second one.
Is that the one with the logs on the truck?
Yes.
Yeah, that still haunts my memories. Like, I've never seen it, but...
It has been appropriately traumatizing, yes.
Yeah. So, apparently this guy dying was the last straw, and locals started selling their cemetery plots and moving loved ones' bodies to different graveyards.
I love that their solution is just like, well, this won't be a cemetery anymore. Take that, Carl.
Eventually, the cemetery was reduced to a single plot, Carl's.
That's no less than he deserves.
It didn't last too long, however, as the land was sold to a mining company and the entire area was turned into a strip mine in 58. So, if you'll remember from the beginning of this story, Carl committed the murder in 38. So, 20 years. Only 20 years of this. Also, I like how all they had to do was not mess with the grave. And it was still easier, I guess, to exhume bodies. Leave it alone?
But no, we'll move every single body in the cemetery and then strip mine the land.
So, it's assumed that the stone ended up with the rest of the rubble from the mine, and a single black and white photo has always been tied to this story. It shows a man in overalls and a newsboy hat leaning against the back of a car. It's unclear if this is actually a photo of Carl Pruitt or how it became attached to the story. The earliest source of the story seems to be Michael Paul Henson's More Kentucky Ghost Stories, which was published in 1996.
A very, you know, stringently researched source, I'm sure.
Researchers have tried to locate Pruitt's death certificate without success, but they have found a death record in Louisville, Kentucky from 1950 for an Enos C. Pruitt who died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
So not the right time or name or place.
I mean, it's C. Pruitt. Could it be Enos? Would you go by fucking Enos if that was your first name?
I mean, okay, that's fair. That's fair. I'll give you that point.
I'm going to send you the picture that is allegedly Carl Pruitt. Actually, no. Tell me first what you're imagining Carl looks like.
Well, you're not going to like it, but I wanted to Google the grave to see what the discoloration looked like. So I've already seen the picture.
You know what he looks like.
Sorry for ruining it.
Okay, well, he looks like Daniel Craig.
Yeah, a little bit. I doubt that is him.
Probably. Yeah, don't mess with headstones. It's rude.
Yeah, just don't. Generally, they don't even have to be cursed. Don't be a dick.
Yeah, I don't care what Carl did. Just leave his shit alone. I mean, I do care what Carl did. Carl's not real.
Yeah. I mean, taking it out on his gravestone in the event it was real, which it isn't.
It's still a dude's gravestone. All right. Our final one is a celebrity.
Uh-oh.
Maybe, kind of. I wanted to make sure to include this one, A, because it doesn't have any deaths linked to it, and B, oh, it'll make sense when we get into the story. So England is, for lack of a better word, lousy with artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean the ones that they stole from other countries.
Those two, but also.
They have their own buried deep in their little fields and shit, like stuff from knights, Celtic druids, Romans. They were just dropping shit all over the place during the literal thousands of years that there have been humans living there.
Do you think that's why England has so many curses, is because they've spent so many centuries pillaging other cultures of their own artifacts that their artifacts are now all cursed?
Yeah.
That makes sense. I like this theory.
Well, it's not even that England has been misbehaving, because let's be real, all of the countries have...
Many countries.
Shit. I mean, yeah. No, I think it's just when you live in a place like America, obviously had people in it for a very, very long period of time. But I'm talking about like the white Europeans specifically.
Because
mm-hmm. America as like a, what's the word I'm looking for? Not civilized.
As a nation?
As a nation is very, very young.
Yes.
Comparatively. Like the US and Canada. So that's why, like, when you get into Europe, where people have been living there in their cities and stuff for thousands of years, there's just a lot more shit to work with.
Correct.
Because, like, in the US, we'll call a building that was built in the 70s old, and then someone from England is like, that is...
My house is built in 1232.
Yeah. Like, we found, you know, part of a knight's armor in my fucking backyard. Like, England's just older.
Dug up a king last week. This parking lot over here.
You are aware of the story of Richard Attenborough finding the skull of a Victorian murder victim. It's one of my favorite stories.
Richard Attenborough, of all people. I love it.
I would love to hear him tell that story. All right. So in 1785, while working his fields in Silchester, I assume that's how it's pronounced, Hampshire. I think the key with English, British English, is you take the second syllable and you just make it one sound.
That sounds about right.
So in Silchester, Hampshire, a farmer stumbled across something while plowing his fields. A ring. A cursed ring. To be more specific, it was a large signet ring with a like concave image of Venus set into it. And the band had 10 facets, which kind of made it look like a smoothed down lug nut.
Okay, yeah, I see what you mean.
Engraved into the outside of the band was the Latin phrase, Senecane vivas in de, backwards. So when it was pressed into wax, the phrase could be read from left to right as, Senecius, live well in God. Senecius? Hold on. I hate ancient Roman names. Senecanus. Sorry.
That sounds about right, yes.
So Senecanus, anus.
This is
I don't know why I didn't notice it.
I'm assuming the edibles just hit.
Live well, baby, in God. Or we assume that's what it was supposed to say because the phrase was misspelled with a double I in the N, which left no room for the O in Deo, which means God. So classic mistake, like when you're making a happy birthday banner.
Yeah, you made the letters too long. I get it. It happens to the best of us.
I'm going to send you a picture of the ring.
I actually haven't looked this one up yet.
That's because I didn't tell you what it was formally called because I didn't want to spoil the story.
I mean, I was just going to start Googling Cursed Ring England.
I mean, it'll just bring up a lot of pictures of Frodo. You can see the spelling mistake on the picture that I sent you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's not what I was picturing.
Really?
I was, yeah, when you said signet ring, I was picturing something much bulkier. It's a nice ring.
Oh, no. Yeah. So it turns out Senecanus may have been running from a curse. So made of gold and dating back to the 4th century, the ring was worth some money and held historic interest, which was great for that farmer. But that's about all it had going at the time because it was 1785 and we didn't know shit. The farmer sold the ring to the Shute family, a well-off and well-connected family living in Hampshire at an estate called the Vine. The ring was added to their collection of antiquities and was mostly forgotten about for 100 years. So fast forward to like the 1800s. About 80 miles away from the farm where the ring was found in Gloucestershire are the ruins of a Roman temple dedicated to the god Nodens, or Nodin, the patron of healing, hunting, and the sea. The land where the ruins are located is officially called Lydney Camp, although is also known as Dwarf's Hill in honor of the creatures that were said to have taken over after the Romans left.
Like Gimli.
Yeah, like that kind of dwarf. So within those ruins was a thin lead tablet with a curse inscribed on it.
Uh-oh.
So little sidebar. So thousands of these lead or stone curse tablets called defixions, have been found across Europe, such as a 7th century defixio found in Cyprus bearing the message, quote, "May your penis hurt when you make love."
Very specific. Good curse.
And the Porcellus Defixio, which features the image of a snake-haired demon above a mummified curse victim. So it's a known thing. That's how Romans curse people. So the Defixio found in Dwarf's Hill read, quote, "For the god Nodens, Sylvanus has lost a ring and has donated one half its worth to Nodens. Among those named Secananus, permit no good health until it is returned to the temple of Nodens."
So this guy stole his ring, and so he put a curse on the ring.
Yeah, I feel like it's not pronounced that way, but I have no reference. Secananus was not a common name, and I'm assuming you've put the puzzle pieces together that it's not a coincidence that a gold ring with his name was found less than 100 miles away from a tablet cursing dudes with his name for stealing a ring. So, like, we can make some assumptions.
Yeah.
So in 1888, Shallowner William Shute, the heir to the Vine estate, wrote about the connection between the lead tablet and the ring in his family's possessions, and the ring in his family's possession in a book, A History of the Vine in Hampshire. His theory was that Secananus stole the ring from Sylvanus while they were both visiting the temple. And it's possible that the thief had his name engraved on the ring in a hurry as kind of like, no, this is my ring. Oh,
it's got my name on it. I don't know what to tell you.
But he was in a hurry and didn't space the letters correctly. And I don't know if engraving can stop a curse, but I mean, it was probably worth a shot. And here's where the story becomes very important. In 1929, an archaeologist named Sir Mortimer Wheeler, the name of my next D&D character.
Let's bring the name Mortimer back.
Right? Mort's fun. Anyway, so he was researching the ring and the tablet while excavating Dwarf's Hill. He needed help researching the etymology of the god name, Nodens, because nerds be nerdin. And man, did he find a nerd to help him with his research. Wheeler got a hold of a well-known expert in Anglo-Saxon and Oxford professor, John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. The Nerd King. Not long after their collaboration, Tolkien released The Hobbit, which, as I'm sure you know, features a cursed ring and dwarves.
Yes. Oh my god, my Gimli joke makes sense.
Yeah. I didn't know if you had figured it out or if you were just being you.
I was just making the only reference to a dwarf's name that I knew off the top of my head.
Sleepy. So we don't have proof that the ring of Sylvanus directly inspired the story, nor do we even have solid evidence that the ring found in the field was the same ring that was mentioned in the stone tablet. But I think that second one, we can kind of, you know, make some assumptions. And the first mm-hmm. one's fun to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. Like, maybe it isn't like it directly inspired him, but, you know, stories yeah. about cursed rings are not uncommon. And
well, if you think about it, the ring doesn't play a huge, I mean, it does a little bit in that it makes Bilbo invisible and he can do some shit, but it doesn't play a huge role in the book.
Yeah, not in The Hobbit.
No. And Lord of the Rings didn't come out until what, the 40s?
40s or 50s? Yeah, 40s, I think.
I think, yeah, late 40s. Anyway, so the original Defixio can be seen at the museum in Lydney Camp, and the vine is now a historic site open to the public where they have both the ring and a copy of the curse tablet on display, along with a first edition copy of The Hobbit.
Fun.
And those are cursed, yeah, and those are cursed objects.
I love that. I love that there was actually no curse to the And it was more interesting for it.
Well, there was a formal curse in the last one, but no one died.
Right.
Because it was a specific curse.
Yes. I mean, yeah, maybe the curse did take effect, but we'll never know.
Maybe that's why the ring was in the middle of a field.
Yeah. Maybe he just keeled
off. Struck by lightning or some shit.
Struck by lightning. Yes.
Anyway. Yeah, I had to get that last one in there. Like, I probably had more in-depth stories that were spookier, but I wasn't going to pass up the one that was like, and that's where the ring came from.
And that's, now you know the rest of the story. I'm trying to think about, no, that took me a few minutes to remember. Yes, that's a fun twist.
I mean, let's see. Of the four that we talked about, the ring is definitely real.
Mm-hmm.
There's a copy of the curse. That's what we got for that. The headstone doesn't exist. We don't have any pictures of it. We don't know if Carl exists, but it was still fun. It was more of a haunted headstone story than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
The paintings, which, I would attribute just simply to law of large numbers. Sounds like everyone exactly. in England had this picture in their home, and things caught on fire a lot in
the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We weren't great at fire safety.
And as far as the chair goes, I don't know. The chair exists.
I mean, I am less convinced when so many of the stories are, well, not so many of the stories, but like the first story is like, oh, all these Canadian airmen sat in the chair and then they died in the war. And I'm like, yeah, that's usually what happens. Like, I think it probably has like, more of the fact to do with the fact that they were airmen.
It was World War II.
In World War II.
Than the chair. Well, and then my favorite was like the delivery guy and the other guy that were like, they were, you know, drinking at the pub and then they got into a car wreck on the way home. It's like, yeah, they were drinking and driving. Anyway, it's, I don't know. It's fun. Cursed objects are fun.
I always love hearing the stories, even if I don't believe the stories, even if I, you know, obviously get great joy out of debunking them. I still enjoy the stories for what they are.
Well, back to what I was saying at the beginning, like, even if they don't have, like, a ghost curse on them, people can convince themselves that curses are real and it has real-world effects.
For real.
Like, maybe someone who had a crying boy painting was thinking about how they had a crying boy painting and, like, was distracted and, like, left the stove on. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, so if you have a cursed object, you can tell us on Instagram at afternoon. Oh, I guess all the pictures, well, the ones that I can find of these objects will be on our Instagram. At Afternoonified. You can tell us about your haunted objects at afternoonifiedpod@gmail.com.
If you have a crying boy painting, why?
Yeah, I would love to know. Unless it's like ironic at this point.
I mean, I'm definitely getting you one for Christmas, if I remember, which I won't.
I'm going to cross-stitch a crying boy. Oh my god, embroider me a crying boy, Sarah.
Lovely.
We're also online at Get Afternoonified. Wow. GetAfternoonified.com, where you can find old episodes. You can buy merch, which we got the good merch. Get yourself a foxy grandpa apron.
Get yourself a business daddy mug.
A business daddy bucket hat, I think.
Does Redbubble do ties? I would love a business daddy tie, specifically because there's a graphic of a tie on it.
Of a tie?
Would be funny.
Y'all want to do Midge 2024? Or what about Midge Allen 2024?
How about Please Kill Me 2024?
Midge John Cena as Mermaid Barbie 2024.
Yeah. I can make my peace with that.
Well, the problem I have with John Cena as a mermaid, and you can quote me on this, is that his body is too square to be aerodynamic, which is not good for swimming.
Mermaids I aren't think you're buff. Right. They can't be, yeah, they got to be like,
there's too much sinewy. Drag.
Yeah, like, look at Michael Phelps. Like, he's definitely, like, bulky, but, like, he's built very differently.
Swimmers are triangular. I mean, if they do butterfly, whatever. I was on swim team for a while. Woo. Yeah, so remember to rate, subscribe, review, all of that fun stuff. And the next episode is cursed. Goodbye.
For more podcasts like the one you just listened to, go to SoBelowMedia.com.
This is as above, so below.